accession number 14592, Reel 1.
Mr. Tutor, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Freshwater in the Isle of Wight.
And which year was that?
1918.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was a regular army. He was caught in the Geddes Axe and retired about 1933. But with the war, he was back in, and he went in the RAF, actually, RAF, actually. Accountancy section. He was a squadron leader he was a flight lieutenant at the beginning of the war, I think.
Did you go to school on the Isle of Wight?
Well, no, because my father was a regular in the army, I was schooled mostly in Scotland, up in Aberdeen, Edinburgh. But I did finish my last 3 or 4 years in the Isle of Wight, yes, at school.
How old were you when you finished your schooling?
Well, about 17, 18.
Did you get a job?
Yes, I did eventually. I went into banking. I was a bank clerk in Bournemouth.
Were you doing that?
Reluctantly. Very reluctantly.
Were you doing that when war broke out?
Oh, no. I joined the RAFER in... I applied about 1938, I suppose, sometime, and then... eventually I was accepted in early 39, about May, June, when I started learning to fly. But I was still with the bank in those days, but I had decided at that stage to leave the bank and go for a short service commission in the RAF.
Had you thought in 38 that a war was coming?
Not necessarily, but of course I should think that in those days, if there were all sorts of things. So the militia came up, and if that frightened a lot of people. By that time I was already in the VR, but of course that frightened a lot of people because they all rushed to join the territorials and things. Otherwise you got called up in the militia. But in 38, of course there were all sorts of scares. But I had joined because I wanted to learn to fly. That was the only reason. And, my father, who was in the RAF by that time, was a bit pessimistic and kept assuring me that it was coming. But I was only concerned with the flying side.
Where did you learn to fly?
At Hamble, down in near Southampton. I was attached to the Bassett Centre, which is in Southampton, for the VR, and I learned to fly at Hamble. I did my 15 days training there in 39, round about June, July. And my ambition, of course, was to... I think you'd done about 80 hours, you could apply to transfer as short service commission. I never quite made it. The war broke out before I'd done the number of hours. But I could, you know, I'd gone solo by then and I was flying. Hamble's a little bit different. It was air service training. It was a bit different to many of the training establishments in that to start with they used cadets, Avro cadets, and not Tiger Moths. But so I trained on those initially.
What kind of people were in the volunteer reserve at that time?
Oh, a complete mixture. Just every type you can think of. I mean, probably, if you like, the best type of volunteer you can get. We were all jolly young, but on the other hand, just from about every kind of job you can think of.
Did you have any problems in learning to fly?
No. VR in the, was rather overwhelmed with applicants, so the medical was mighty sticky. They did that to try and keep numbers down. And also it was the same with the flying. You had a flying test, I remember, after about 12 hours or 14 hours or something like that. And I remember at the end of that being told I'd never make a pilot. And but that they give me sort of one more chance. So there again, I think on the day I actually took that test, they failed about something like 3 out of about 5 of us. So they were obviously trying to sort them out purely because of the numbers they had.
Did you hear the broadcast of Neville Chamberlain that we were at war with Germany?
No, I didn't, because on that particular day I was at Bassett. We were reporting for duty every day, and because I was called up, I suppose, somewhere in back end of August, and we were going in every day at Bassett. I didn't actually hear it. We'd been dismissed, I think, probably about midday. And a conductor on the tram told me when I was on my way home.
How did you take the news?
I was probably rather excited about it, I think. That's the general reaction, I think, in those days. You're all very young. You didn't know what it was all about, really. And it was just that I'm going to be flying, you know. I think that was probably the great thing.
What happened to you with the declaration of war?
We hung around at Bassett for about, I should think, about 2 or 3 weeks. And then on the round about the 25th of September, I was posted to Hastings ITW for initial training. And we went down there and did nothing but drill and PT and so on at Hastings, very pleasant, for about 5 or 6 weeks, I don't quite know how long for, before I was posted again. And if you'd done 100 hours or so, you went straight to EFTS, but if you'd done less, you went back and did your ab initio right from scratch. In other words, I was posted back by coincidence to Hamble, and you had a course of chaps who, some of them like myself, who'd done a few hours flying, and some who'd done none at all and were going from scratch. And we did our ab initio there. It was very fortunate from my point of view, because of course I'd already done about 40 or 50 hours. And but I didn't like it at the time. I thought I'd missed out. But in actual fact, it was of great benefit, because I then had a complete session of training all over again. So I did a lot of hours on very elementary types.
What was your reaction to RAF discipline in this latter part of 39?
Oh, I liked it. I thought the life was wonderful, actually. Discipline didn't worry me. I wasn't concerned with it. It was all a very pleasant life, actually.
Why did you think the life was so wonderful?
Well, for one thing, we were well paid. And I suddenly realised that the one thing I really wanted to do was fly. I was terribly keen. And that was what made it, I suppose, so enjoyable. I was doing something I liked, and I was being paid for doing it.
Were you surprised at the long period of relative inactivity at the beginning of the war?
Well, I know a number of people were. They got very agitated because, you know, we didn't seem to make a lot of progress. But, in fact, I just thought it was all very pleasant. And we got to realise, of course, that they were short of aerodromes more than anything. Nothing much was happening initially in the air war. And we weren't losing people, weren't losing aircraft. It was a bit of an old bottleneck, really, and so, of course, we got held up. But I mean, that we understood that, I think. Although I suppose we got a bit impatient because the tendency was to want to get on with it, you know.
How did your training progress in that winter of 39-40?
Well, it went very well. We had a... it was a very bad winter, a lot of snow, but the training went okay. And in, I suppose, January, February, we went off to EFTS, which was up in Kinloss in Scotland, which was a bit of a change. Still had a bit of snow up there, but we transferred onto Oxford's there. In those delightful days, you had some sort of choice of going on singles or twins. And the blokes who went on singles went on Harvard's. And if you went on twins, you went on Oxford's. I was rather keen on going on twins. I never aspired to being a fighter pilot, because I'd long decided that if I survived at all, I'd want to keep flying, and the idea, if you're going to keep flying, you want to be on twins.
And after Kinloss?
Oh, Kinloss, well, while we were up there, the Norwegian campaign broke out, and there was a frightful shambles. They sent a Wellington squadron up there to operate against Norway, and almost at the same time and overnight they shifted the whole training school from Kinloss down to Cranfield in Bedfordshire. And I flew one of the kites down, but we moved the whole school virtually overnight. And of course, so we finished our FTS down at Cranfield. And we had a jolly good time at Cranfield. It was very nice. We finished there, I suppose, somewhere about April, May 40. And of course, we got our wings there. So by that time I was a qualified pilot, and I was posted to an OTU at Harwell, where I went on to Wellington's, and
what was it like flying the Wellington?
Well, it was a bit of a change. I'd seen some Wellingtons, of course, up at Kinloss, and I saw them come back there from the Norwegian dues, and I thought they were pretty big kites, and of course they were. They were the biggest aircraft in the RAF at that time. So it was quite something to go on, because most of my course were very unlucky in that they went on either Hamdens or Blenheims. There were only two out of the whole crowd of us who went on Wellingtons. We went to Harwell, and I don't know why. I mean, I don't know why you don't know any of these things in the RAF. But it was nice to... They were nice kites to fly. And I was at Harwell. The Germans did one very heavy raid on the aerodrome at one stage, when they hit various aircraft and goodness knows what. That was during the time when they suddenly switched to bombing airfields.
Where were you when they launched the raid?
I was in the sergeant's mess, actually. And no real warning. I mean, I think the sirens went after the raid, but so... It was pretty exciting, I believe, because there were a lot of Bowsers up at the roundabout where the bombs fell, and there were fires. I don't think there were any casualties, I can't remember. There may have been one or two, but there weren't many. They did Boscombe Down the same day, I believe, because that was nasty. And I remember we flew over to have a look at Boscombe Down. And Harwell was all right. It was a bit dodgy from an OTU point of view, in that it wasn't a good airfield. It had a hill at the end of the main runway. Well, they didn't have runways in those days, but where the main direction of takeoff. And somebody used to tend to fly into the hill at regular intervals when we were doing night flying. And so for that reason, we quite often used to go and do our night flying at places like Boscombe Down or somewhere like that.
How long did this raid last that the Germans launched on Harwell?
Oh, it was very quick and sudden. I suppose it was all over in a matter of a few minutes. They hit various aircraft that were parked. And the trouble was, I think, that one or two were burnt out completely. One was probably hit, and then it set various others on fire. It was all good, exciting stuff. But I don't think there were many casualties, if any.
So, people in the sergeant's mess, did they just dive under the table?
Oh, oh yes, yes. You just sort of threw yourself wherever it was, because you had we had another semi-raid very nearly. I was on duty pilot one day there, and they used to have this they did drop something fairly close to us, but the only amusing thing I remember about that was that they used to come through on the phone and say yellow alert and all this sort of thing, and if they said red alert, you expected to hear the sirens, because it meant that it was going to be on them right with you. But on this occasion, I'd been given the job of duty pilot, and I was stuck in the duty pilot's office, and we had sandbags all round, and I don't think any of the bombs fell on the aerodrome at all. But after it was all over, the phone rang and they came through and said red alert. So they were a bit late off the mark there on some of these things. But these were daylight raids, and they were going on all over, I suppose, in the south at that time. This was when they switched to doing aerodromes rather than... I think before that they were doing... convoys, radar stations, and so on. And then they suddenly switched to aerodromes. And
who did you get the impression was winning the Battle of Britain at that time?
Oh, we were quite sure that we were winning, because of if you like to call it propaganda. I mean, the papers and everything were giving these fantastic scores. We were sort of thrilled a bit, thought that I know the figures were somewhat heavily weighted, but in our favour, but as it later turned out, definitely we thought we were on top of this sort of thing.
Did people develop an affection for the Wellington?
Oh yes, she was an extremely good kite in many ways. As I say, we didn't know of anything better. I mean, as it turned out, it was all very primitive, but they were certainly superior to virtually anything else in the bomber line at that time. And she was easy to handle. She didn't have some of the extreme vices that, say, the Hampden had. And she wasn't... so dead easy to fly as a Whitley. I mean, you could pretty well fly a Whitley hands off, as far as I'm told. But so she was a sensible aircraft. In other words, you had to fly her, but she didn't have any wicked vices, and she was just a nice aircraft.
What size of crew did a Wellington have?
Well, in those days, we had six. By the time I got to squadron, we always had six, because, of course, there was no such thing as an automatic pilot or anything like that. So we always had a second pilot. Whereas later in the war, I think they got it, reduced it to five. But we had always had six, which was two gunners and a wireless op and a navigator and two pilots.
Who was in your crew and how was it formed?
Well, when I got to Feltwell, I was posted there, 75 NZ Squadron. The idea was, of course, that... 75 had quite a history. They had literally, the New Zealanders had presented the Wellingtons to the RAF, and there was some sort of an agreement that it would be an RAF squadron, but that it would be primarily manned by New Zealanders. But in actual fact, of course, this was more difficult than they thought originally. And at the time I was there, I should say only about 40% of the personnel were New Zealanders. We had a few New Zealand navigators, a few gunners, a few pilots. I think we even had a few ground crew, but not many. So that at that time, you only had about 40% New Zealanders, if that, in the squadron. I had three New Zealanders in my crew. The rest were British. And that was a pretty average sort of setup at that particular time.
Did you have freedom to pick who was in your own crew?
Well, no, crew picking in the RAF was always rather strange. Before you left the OTU, you all sort of used to mill around in a hangar and sort of pick yourselves. And I've seen this referred to a number of times. It was all rather strange. I automatically paired up with the chap who'd been on the same course as I had all the way through as a couple of pilots. We had a New Zealand navigator who we were very friendly with. He wanted to be with us, so that was that. And then we acquired a wireless op and a rear gunner. The rear gunner was a New Zealander, and he sort of knew my navigator, but it was that sort of thing. There was nothing, you didn't have any real option of picking. There was another navigator I was rather keen on. I was very friendly with him, and I thought he was, but I didn't get him simply on the grounds that my own eventual navigator, Hugh English, was very keen to be with us in particular, so he came, and that was it. And we went off to the squadron as a crew. When you got to the squadron, what they normally did was they took one of the pilots away and he went as a second dickie with another crew, and you got an experienced captain, which is what, and this is what happened in my case. I got a Sergeant Stubbs took over. He took over our crew. He'd just become a skipper, captain. And Pete Major, who'd been with me as a pilot, he went off as a second pilot with another crew. So that's sort of how it got itself sorted out. So we were a SPROG crew, in effect, with an experienced skipper.
What impression did the squadron make on you in terms of personnel and leadership and morale when you first joined it?
Well, it was very good. Very good, but quite a surprise in many ways. I mean, they insisted that because it was a New Zealand squadron that they were a bit laid back, was the idea, and there was definitely no bullshit. So it was a good squadron to be in for that reason. It wasn't entirely like that. It depended very much on which flight commander you had. But when I was there, mostly we were very lucky. We had a short spell with a flight commander who, the British chap, who didn't go down very well. But after that, we got a chap named Gary Kane, who was our flight commander on B flight, and he was an exceptional bloke. So that provided you had that sort of setup, it was all pretty good.
Why did the other chap not go down very well?
He wasn't very popular. By reputation, he wasn't. He used to, according to the chiefy who was in charge, of course, of all the mechanics and getting the kites organised, he was inclined to, if he thought the raid was a bit dodgy, that was supposed to be the idea, he would say there was something wrong with the aircraft, and they would spend hours on the aircraft and sorting it out when couldn't find much wrong. This may be pure rumour, but he was unpopular with us as air crews because he was a bit of a martinet. And we weren't used to that, or by that time we weren't used to that sort of thing. And he used to get pretty hot on, carrying gas masks and all sorts of stupid regulations, at least that we thought were stupid. He knew he was unpopular. Even when he departed, he admitted that he knew that, but I think he just liked being that way.
Do you remember your first operation with 75?
Oh, yes. By that time, the idea was, or rather the idea, by that time, the invasion was a possibility. And, of course, I think the first two or three raids we did were all on barge concentrations in France. I think the first one we did was probably Ostend. I remember it very well, but in actual fact, very little happened. There was a very bad cloud cover. We didn't locate the target. And our skipper decided to return without dropping the bombs. That was the drill in those days. If you couldn't find your target, you were supposed to bring your bombs back. These were very early days, and so we did. But for a short while, he became known, certainly with the ground crews, as bring them back alive stubs, because it was the only time we ever did that. But on the other hand, as it was one's first trip, although nothing materially really happened, we saw a bit of flak, but nothing very exciting. As it's your first trip, of course, you get a bit agitated. But it all went very well. There was no problem.
And the second, do you remember that?
Well, I think that was much better. We went to Le Havre or somewhere, and that was a fairly effective as far as we could tell, and that was quite exciting. But of course, these were nice short trips, and you were there and back in about what we thought were short trips, 4 or 5 hours, and that was good. That was fine as far as we were concerned. I don't remember anything particularly eventful about it, but